From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. In Fultondale, Alabama today, people are cleaning up after a devastating tornado. The tornado struck the Birmingham suburb late last night, killing at least one person and injuring many more. Fultondale resident Tim Herring lost his home. He told WBRC-TV.
We took off to the bathroom. My wife was trying to find the cats. I said, forget the cats. Get in the tub, and the shower curtain luckily fell right over the top of us. I could feel boards falling and hitting me and sheetrock, and the whole house was rocking and shaking, and then it quit.
Andrew Yeager of member station WBHM joins us now from Birmingham. Andrew, give us a sense of the damage from this storm.
Well, devastation is the word to describe it. You have some neighborhoods where homes have been leveled, trees and power lines torn up and thrown about. The trees that are still standing are mostly shorn of their branches. There was a hotel that was hit, and part of the roof and walls were blown off, and you could peer into part of the hotel like a dollhouse. And officials say that the local high school in Fultondale suffered damage. And while assessments are still underway, one county official says it doesn't look good.
Wow. Tornadoes are not entirely uncommon in January in Alabama, but this one does seem to have been particularly powerful. What do we know about that?
Yeah, you're exactly right. Tornadoes can happen and do happen year-round in Alabama, even powerful ones. Crews from the National Weather Service say that they'll be out to look at the damage to figure out just exactly how strong this tornado was. I'm not a meteorologist, but from what we're seeing, it does seem like this is not just a minor low-level storm.
And how much of a warning, if any, did residents get to try to protect themselves?
Well, meteorologists had said to expect storms and possible severe weather. And later on in the day, on Monday, they bumped up their forecast to say that there were better chances for tornadoes. Tornado watch was issued, so it wasn't like there was no warning. But with all that said, people who rode out this storm do say it seemed to come suddenly. And tornadoes at night are somewhat difficult to deal with because many people are sleeping and they may not be on alert. And not everyone might have a weather radio by the beds. So a tornado might be surprising.
And as we said, at least one person is dead. I understand someone was sheltering in the basement of a house that collapsed. What do we know about the people who were also injured?
Well, the latest numbers that we got this morning from local authorities are that 30 people were injured. 18 of them were taken to the hospital. They are still performing search and rescue operations. One of the focuses is that hotel, just to make sure that everyone's accounted for and no one's left in a room. And just one note on that one fatality. Officials here say that it was a 14-year-old boy. And yes, he was sheltering in place in a basement, and he was doing exactly what he was supposed to do. But still, tornadoes can bring tragic results.
Yeah. And so now, Andrew, other folks who've been displaced are going to need places to shelter. They're going to need assistance. And then you throw that against the backdrop of the pandemic. You know, is that complicating the effort to aid people who've lost their homes now?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little unclear at this point how much the pandemic complicates things. Some of that depends on how many people need shelter and such. But emergency responders are familiar with tornadoes, and we've actually kind of had this conversation already about the pandemic and natural disasters around hurricane season, which, of course, involves a lot more people, evacuations, shelters. And officials that I talked to back during hurricane season were somewhat low-key, basically telling me emergency planners deal with lots of complications, and the pandemic was just another factor to consider.
Sure, although it's sort of layers one crisis on top of another. That's WBHM's Andrew Yeager. Andrew, thanks for bringing us the latest.
Good to be with you.
So we'll keep a close eye on that recovery effort in the meantime. We're going to have a couple conversations today about who gets vaccinated, when, and in what order. With that in mind, let's hear from Eugenia South. She's an emergency physician who treats COVID-19 patients. So she was eligible right away to get vaccinated in Pennsylvania, where she works. At first, she resisted. She didn't want the shot. Though eventually, she changed her mind. Dr. South recently wrote about her vaccine hesitancy in an editorial for NBC News. And she joins us now. Doctor, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. And you know, a lot of people would be surprised to hear that a doctor was so close to refusing this vaccine. How close were you to skipping the shot?
Well, in late November, when I realized that I would be amongst the first to be offered the vaccine because I work in the emergency department, I was absolutely not going to get it. But
really?
Yet on December 17th, I got my vaccine on the second day that it was available to people at Penn Medicine.
Okay, so we'll talk about your evolution here. First of all, starting with why. What were you worried about?
Yeah, so I had a few concerns. One was the speed at which the vaccine was developed. Nothing happens that quickly in medicine. So I was concerned that given the speed, was it really safe? And one of the things I, you know, learned about was that the mRNA technology that's at the core of the vaccine had been under development for decades, and I didn't know that at first. Another thing that I was concerned about was a potential long-term side effect that we wouldn't know from the trials because they only followed people for a few months. And one of the things I learned and sort of was able to overcome that concern was that for vaccines generally, the side effects really occur in the first few days to weeks, that long-term side effects are incredibly rare.
So you laid out the medical concerns here, and I just want to point out, you're not a vaccine skeptic, as far as I can tell. You get the flu shot, you vaccinate your kids. But there was another part of the calculation, it sounds like you were making, which is part of your own personal identity, and that you are a Black doctor, and you have, by your accounts, experienced racism in healthcare. How did that factor into your thinking that you didn't want to get the shot?
You know, one of the underlying questions about mistrust in healthcare and mistrust in systems generally and racism is that, you know, people ask themselves and I ask myself, you know, does this system always have my best interest at heart? And the answer is no. And I've had countless examples of my own experiences of racism within medicine, what I have seen and observed other people experiencing and patients experiencing, and then sort of just at a systems level, the ways that racism manifests in healthcare. You know, the example of pain and how pain is treated and assessed in Black patients, I can very vividly remember a young Black man who had come into our emergency department after assault, and he was asked by the triage nurse, "What's your level of pain?" And this young man who looked very calm, he said, "It's a 10. And the nurse stopped and stared, you know, deeply into his eyes and said, "Are you sure you're telling me this is the worst pain of your life?" And he sort of shrunk back a little bit, and she said, "So tell me again, what is your level of pain?" And he said, 10, sort of a question at this point. And this is not unique to where I work. This happens, you know, all over the place. I think another example of how I see and many other Black individuals in healthcare see racism manifests more at a systemic level is the segregation of care. People who have private insurance are often seen in a clinic that is physically separate from people who have Medicaid or other public insurance. And the privately insured patients are seen often only by faculty, whereas Medicaid patients are seen by residents and supervised by a faculty member. And even if the quality of care were equal, we have to ask ourselves, why do we separate patients within healthcare by insurance status, which often tracks by race? And so all of these experiences that Black people have all the time in medicine sort of go into informing how I think about getting the vaccine.
I wonder how you were judged by your fellow doctors and healthcare professionals, because you write in your piece that you want to normalize the hesitancy to take a brand new vaccine, saying that shaming people is not going to help. Did you experience that?
I did not experience that, but I have heard that and seen that written about the fact that there is so much hesitancy, particularly amongst the Black community. I think very strongly that we have to say it's okay to be hesitant to take something new. That's actually normal. And so I hope by in normalizing that, we can then open spaces for, you know, conversation to allow people to get their questions answered in non-judgmental ways that will equip them to have the information they need to make an informed decision for themselves.
So what role do you think doctors like you have in making sure that people trust the vaccine?
What I found after I got my vaccine, the next shift that I had in the emergency department, I tried to talk to as many Black colleagues in the ED as I could about my decision. And most of those people were either environmental services or transport or unit clerks or registration. And I, time and time again, mostly heard, "I'm not sure, I think I want to wait." So I was able to talk with them, share my own hesitation about getting the vaccine, share the reasons why I decided to get it, and answer their questions. And what I found was, for many of them, that was the first time they had the opportunity to talk to a physician, period, let alone a Black physician, about their questions. And some people actually, you know, changed their minds and made a decision that they would get the vaccine. So it's absolutely important to empower Black physicians, but also more broadly, just trusted messengers who can, you know, provide people with information and answer questions.
And how are you feeling now that you've gotten vaccinated? Are you happy you did it?
Absolutely. I've already gotten my second shot, and the shift that I worked in the emergency department after I got that shot was the first time in 10 months that I went to work without fear, without wondering if this was the time I'm going to get COVID. Is this the time I'm going to bring COVID home to my family? So it was actually pretty liberating to be able to go to work and feel safe.
Dr. Eugenia South, Assistant Professor of Emergency Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. South, thank you for your time, and we're going to link people up to your editorial at NBC News at hereandnow.org. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Very fine people on both sides. That's what then-President Donald Trump said when a group of protesters, including white nationalists, marched in Charlottesville, Virginia in 2017 and clashed with counter-protesters. The event was a brazen display of racism and anti-Semitism, and it claimed the life of a young woman named Heather Heyer. When Joe Biden launched his presidential campaign a year and a half later, the first two words of his announcement were, "Charlottesville, Virginia." The ugliness of the so-called Unite the Right rally and Trump's response helped inspire Biden's bid for the presidency. Yet as Biden called for unity in his inaugural address last week, many in Charlottesville were still healing from what they call the summer of hate. And some are wondering, how is unity achieved? And why has Biden never visited the city that sparked his campaign? We were going to check in with two faith leaders in Charlottesville, beginning with the Reverend Phil Woodson. He's the associate pastor at First United Methodist Church in Charlottesville. He was one of the counter-protesters that day in 2017. Reverend, thanks for joining us.
Of course.
Reverend, would you go back with us to that rally? You saw the anger and hate firsthand. What have the past 3.5 years been like for you? How have you managed to heal, if you've managed to heal?
Well, first I want to say that Charlottesville is much more than the events of that specific summer. And there's a very clear theme amongst members of the Charlottesville community that we want to be more than that summer. But in many ways, we are still a town that's still traumatized and still struggling in many ways, not only to address these overt attacks by white nationalists, but also dealing with systemic white supremacy that permeates through, you know, our educational system, our housing systems, healthcare, policing. And so we, like many around the country, are trying to navigate through this time and do so in a way that brings forth justice and equity. And I think that will lead to unity.
Well, with the systemic nature of the problem in mind, Reverend, I wonder how you were processing the more recent event that we saw just a few weeks ago in our nation's capital, because some of the same white supremacist iconography and ideology was on full display that day. And so anyone who thought that we had moved past the events of Charlottesville was in for a rude awakening. Do you connect those two events?
President Biden's election has elevated both our common faith tradition and the traumatic events that occurred in Charlottesville. And I highlight those two because it is both my faith and the lived experience that I've had in this community that have shaped my understandings of justice and righteousness, what it means to develop and maintain a community and a sense of unity and common purpose. And so the connection between what we saw on January 6th and what the Charlottesville community saw is just this unbridled evil of white supremacy on full display.
It must be painful, though, Reverend, for you to see such hateful acts carried out, in some cases, in the name of Christianity, in the name of your faith tradition. How do you handle that?
Oh, absolutely. But the pain that I feel is limited in many regards, because my hope and my joy comes from someplace else that is not of this world. But over the past few years, 5 years actually, as a local pastor here in Charlottesville with the United Methodist Church, the real pain is what I've been able to see and bear witness to, and that is the many ways that the Black and the Brown and Indigenous people of this area have been repeatedly harmed by white supremacy.
One other thing I'm wondering, though, Reverend, is that you pointed out in a New York Times article on this same subject that President Biden, although he says that he drew inspiration from the events in Charlottesville to launch his White House campaign, he actually hasn't visited your city since that day. Is that a big missing piece of his plan, his effort to unite the country?
Yes and no. Charlottesville is not unlike other cities that need to be visited, that need the care of and the attention of leadership who have promised to help and support them. You know, we too, like many cities and communities across the country, we're struggling to provide adequate and equitable access to technology and education. We're working to provide food and shelter for unhoused people. And so if President Biden and members of his administration want to come to Charlottesville, I hope that they come to listen and to learn from the people who have been doing the hard and necessary work of loving each other in this community. That's what I hope happens. Charlottesville does not want to be a political backdrop or jumping off point. We're people just like everyone else across the country who's struggling with these issues and trying to work through these hard things together.
That's the Reverend Phil Woodson, Associate Pastor at First United Methodist Church in Charlottesville, Virginia. Reverend, thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thank you.
We want to turn now to another faith leader in Charlottesville. Back in 2017, on that day of the Unite the Right rally, Diane Hillman was vice president of Congregation Beth Israel, the only synagogue in Charlottesville. Torahs had been moved to another house for their safety, and an armed guard had been hired. Outside the synagogue, in broad daylight, there was a sea of Nazi imagery. White supremacists marched and chanted. Today, Diane Hillman is president of Congregation Beth Israel, and she joins us now. Diane, welcome.
Good morning.
Did you ever think that you would see, in America, the kind of naked anti-Semitism that you witnessed that day?
Never in my life did I expect to ever experience something like this.
Have you and the Jewish community in Charlottesville healed since that day, since it was such a shocking and traumatic event?
I think we have changed. I don't know that we have completely healed. I don't know that this is a wound that will ever completely heal. There are too many events in our history going back 50, 100 years that many of us have either experienced personally or through our parents and relatives. So this is just a continuation of what started eons ago.
And right up until recently, it was only in 2018, of course, that we saw the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh, where 11 were dead and 6 were wounded. So do you feel safe in America today as a Jewish woman?
I don't feel as safe as I did before 2017. I always felt that I was invisible, that I was in a bubble, looked like a white person, and hid behind that bubble. But depending on where you live, people know that you're Jewish based on the way you speak and the way you look. And I had never felt frightened by that before. And now I'm much more aware of it in a negative way than I was before.
I wonder, too, how you're feeling as we're in this moment with a new administration. We just heard President Biden in his inaugural address last week call for lowering the temperature in this country. And yet he said that on the site of the insurrection at the Capitol that happened just 2 weeks earlier, an insurrection where we saw many participants holding anti-Semitic iconography. So is the kind of unity that the president is calling for even possible when we've just seen this display of white nationalism and anti-Semitism?
I think it is possible for a larger segment of the population that had never seen or experienced anything like that before. And I think there's the possibility for learning among the people who never truly understood those challenges. And I think what we're going to see is a different kind of divide where people who just stuck with slogans but really didn't understand them may start to understand them and to realize how dangerous they are. I think there's a segment of the population that fully understands what those slogans mean and they believe them. And I am hopeful that those who will begin to understand will take up a larger proportion of our population.
So do you have any advice then, Diane, for President Biden, who's facing a country that is so divided over really basic things like truth and lies? And what can he learn from you and the Jewish community in Charlottesville about healing from trauma?
I do. I think that people need to be a little bit kinder and gentler towards those they disagree with and to not pose it as a face-off, but instead engage in learning together. Not back people into corners, because that's what we do now. We make people defensive about what may or may not be their deep beliefs, and we force them to make those beliefs even deeper than they might have been. And if we could back away a little bit and begin to educate in a way that's non-threatening, we might make more progress than constant abrasive fighting.
That's Diane Hillman. She is the president of Congregation Beth Israel in Charlottesville, Virginia. Diane, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
We are still in the middle of this pandemic, and right now, having science news you can trust, from variants to vaccines, is essential. NPR Shortwave has your back. About 10 minutes every weekday, listen and subscribe to Shortwave, the daily science podcast from NPR.
Some young women from Dallas are among the first in the country to earn the highest rank in scouting. They're about to make Eagle Scout. Becca Moore from member station KERA has their story.
On a chilly morning at the Trinity River Audubon Center in South Dallas, a group of young women scouts from Troop 890 use shovels and pickaxes to chip away at the hard dirt.
I think this one's about done.
I think this one's about done, too.
They're digging holes for new display cases that'll hold information about the local plants and animals visitors can find along the Audubon Center's primitive trails. The display is designed and handcrafted by 17-year-old Emma Duncan. It's the last requirement she needs to complete to earn the rank of Eagle Scout.
I wanted to do something where I could work outdoors and work with my hands, and I had no idea where to start.
So Duncan reached out to the Audubon Center. Jake Poinsett's the program manager there, and he's been working with Duncan on her project since midsummer.
We had an initial meet and greet in the beginning where she kind of said what her idea is going to be like. And all we did was say, you know, a couple of suggestions, you know, so we will clear out this area. What if it looked like this? Or what if it was this size? And she ran with it and did everything herself.
With family, friends, and fellow scouts around her, Duncan put the display cases in the ground and cemented them in place, officially completing her Eagle Scout requirements.
This has been most of my life for the past few months, and I'm very excited to be done with it, as fun as it was.
Then she pulls off the clear plastic coating to reveal her project.
Gorgeous! Well done.
Duncan is now one step closer to becoming an Eagle Scout, the most prestigious rank in Boy Scouts. And she wasn't even allowed to join until February of 2019. That's when the Scouts BSA started letting young women in. And Duncan says she knew right away she wanted to join and become an Eagle Scout.
Me and my dad were backpacking. And on the way out, he said, "Hey, you know, it's looking like girls in Boy Scouts is going to be a thing. Is that something you might be interested in?" I said, "Well, absolutely." We started thinking about, you know, what would it look like to go about getting Eagle, you know, time limits, and is that something I'm interested in? And it totally was.
Duncan was already 16 when she was able to join the Scouts, so she only had 2 years to finish all the Eagle Scout requirements. That's also the minimum amount of time it takes to earn the rank. And doing so in such a short time is no small feat. Scouts are not only expected to live by their oath, there's also a lot of hard work involved.
You need 21 merit badges, and you need to have served in a leadership position for 6 months. So then, you complete your Eagle project, and you fill out the application, you get a bunch of recommendation letters, and then you have to sit for sort of a conference with some of the leaders in the troop.
That board reviews each Scout's application and decides whether they're ready to receive the Eagle Scout rank and pin. Checking off those boxes so quickly makes Duncan and a few other girls in her troop some of the first in the country who will earn that rank. 17-year-old Scout Carolyn Rich is one of them.
I'm really honored to have this opportunity because I never thought I would when I was little. Like, I didn't think this was something I'd be doing, especially not in, like, the earliest group of girls.
Duncan says she's also proud to be among the first group of women to earn the Eagle Scout rank. But it's not just about the title.
Before, I did a lot of camping just with my dad, and that was a lot of fun. But getting to hang out with a group of girls that I'm actually friends with and enjoy being around has been super valuable.
For Duncan and Rich, it's a waiting game now. They'll officially earn their Eagle Scout rank and pin at a special ceremony next month. In the meantime, they're focused on helping other members of the troop make it to the finish line as well. For Here and Now, I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
Vaccine distribution has been haphazard in many parts of the country. Each state has different rules about who can get a shot and when. In Pennsylvania, hospital administrators and researchers are getting vaccinated before some frontline workers. In fact, even some people working from home who have no contact with patients are finding themselves ahead in the line. Sarah Bowden of member station WESA in Pittsburgh has been reporting on this. Sarah, welcome.
Hey, Peter. Thanks for having me.
Sure. And what exactly is happening with vaccinations at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center?
Yeah, so some of the people my co-reporters and I spoke with acknowledged that they didn't really have a particularly pressing need for vaccine compared to others in more high-risk jobs or people with certain health conditions. And, you know, some of the folks that we've spoke to, as you mentioned, they've been working from home since the start of the pandemic, and they have jobs in departments like insurance services and communications and fundraising. And more than one person told me that they actually wish that they could have given up their vaccination spot to their parent instead of them. And they also told me that they felt weird about accepting the vaccine, but ultimately decided to do so because it was in the best interest of their personal health.
So people who are not working directly with patients are getting the shots.
Yes.
What about the other way around? Who's not getting a vaccine that should?
Yeah, so people who should probably be getting a vaccine, but who work within UPMC facilities might include, for example, an American Sign Language interpreter. My colleague Kylie Kuzinski, who I co-reported this, told me that there's a gentleman who, because he's a contractor who works for an agency, hasn't gotten vaccinated, even though he works within UPMC facilities. Also medical and nursing students at UPMC facilities who are supposed to be vaccinated but under state guidelines because they work directly with patients have had to go elsewhere for their vaccinations and are struggling to find vaccines because, you know, availability is so finite.
Yeah, well, we know the federal government has really left it up to states to decide how to distribute those doses. What do the guidelines say about where you are in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so Pennsylvania and federal guidelines are essentially the same, and they are vague at best. And it's up to the organizations who have received the vaccine to decide how to interpret these guidelines because they're the ones administering the vaccine. And therefore, UPMC can make decisions like what it did with vaccinating employees who have been working from home. But what I can tell you is that Pennsylvania has said that people who are currently eligible for vaccinations are those who are most at risk for contracting COVID-19, such as healthcare workers. And therefore, I think it's very fair to ask UPMC if it was appropriate to vaccinate certain groups who don't work within medical facilities. And especially while so many healthcare workers and people at long-term care facilities are still waiting for their vaccination.
Sarah Bowden, a reporter with member station WESA in Pittsburgh. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Because of the coronavirus pandemic, 29 million adults and at least 17 million children are facing food insecurity across the U.S. To address this, President Joe Biden last week signed an executive order that expands various food benefits programs to help those who have suffered the most in the economic pullback.
A lot of these folks are facing eviction, are waiting hours in their cars, waiting to be able to feed their children as they drive up to a food bank. It's the United States of America, and they're waiting to feed their kids.
Now, the president's order is part of his $1.9 trillion COVID relief package. Lisa Davis is the senior vice president of Share Our Strength Charity. It's the parent organization of the No Kid Hungry campaign, and she joins us now from Maryland. Lisa, welcome, and thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on, Callum.
So, Lisa, this new executive order calls for change to the way we address food insecurity in the U.S. And I want to start with SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Some people know it by its old name, food stamps. Can you explain how this is going to change, how the program is going to change, and how it might impact the people who qualify for food stamps?
So the executive order basically increases grocery benefits for families that are struggling in the wake of the COVID crisis. It gives them additional dollars on a program called Pandemic EBT, which serves kids who would be relying on free and reduced price lunches if the school buildings were open. And it directs USDA to increase benefits for some of the poorest families on SNAP. And then recognizing how inadequate SNAP benefits are, they equal only about $1.40 per person per meal. It also takes steps to start looking at making those benefits correspond with actual food prices and the time that families have to prepare food to modernize those benefits.
I think supplemental, right, is really the key word there, as you point out, that it is not enough to carry you through the entire month. And just to fill in the detail, the president wants to increase this special pandemic EBT program that you mentioned by 15% as a way of compensating for some of the meals that students may have lost if they were eating breakfast and lunch at school. Could you just fill in some more detail, Lisa, on how important those school-based meal programs are and what the loss of that has been during a pandemic when so many students are learning remotely?
Yes, school meal programs are critical. There are about 28 million kids that receive free or reduced price school meals. And when COVID started closing schools in March, our school nutrition professionals had to stand up entirely new meal programs literally over a weekend. And so at schools across the country, families can still come and pick up meals for their kids to take home. But there are a lot of families that don't have transportation, might be living with medically vulnerable relatives and limiting their trips into the community. And so it's really important that we have this program, Pandemic EBT, which gives those families money so that they can buy groceries to provide meals to their kids at home.
You know, I think there's rightly a big focus on children here. And you know, before the pandemic, there were about 10.7 million kids living in homes that were struggling with hunger in the U.S. That new estimate is up to 17 million. And I think the ripple effect there can mean that parents are skipping meals and making tough decisions to make sure that their children are fed. So I wonder if you could speak to that for a moment, Lisa. I mean, what is the root cause there and what can we do about it?
Yeah, Callum, I think it's important to realize that before COVID hit, we had ending child hunger in our sight lines. The number was the lowest it had been since 1998 when USDA started tracking it. So we know what works. And you're absolutely right. One of the strategies that families use to cope when they don't have enough resources for food is that parents skip meals so that their kids can eat. We know that kids that experience hunger are in poorer health. We know that they perform less well in school. And so the consequence of not making sure that our kids are nourished is very significant.
So in the bigger picture then, Lisa, I mean, what else would you like to see the new administration and Congress do to address hunger? Because it may be the direct programs like SNAP and WIC, or perhaps you're looking to something like increasing the child tax credit, which President Biden would like to do. And that would be just sort of money in the pocket, perhaps, that parents could use as they see fit, and it might be for food. Is it that kind of thing or something else?
I think any programs that get dollars to struggling families have a demonstrated impact on families' food security and also help serve to stimulate the economy. That's why SNAP is such a powerful tool. We know that families quickly spend the dollars on food, which is a basic necessity, and that helps keep folks employed at local grocery stores. That money gets poured back into the economy. When we look at the health and economic devastation facing communities all across the country, I think the risk is not that we spend too much. The risk is that we don't spend enough. And if we don't take action now, we really risk having a lost generation of children.
Yeah, there are so many overlapping issues there, and we'll have to watch and see how much of this pandemic relief package the president is able to pass through Congress. Lisa Davis is the senior vice president of Share Our Strength Charity. It's the parent organization of No Kid Hungry campaign. Lisa, thanks so much for your time and your good work.
Oh, thanks for having me, Callum.
An independent oversight board at Facebook is taking on one of the most consequential decisions in the history of social media, whether to allow former President Trump back onto the platform. Facebook and Twitter banned Trump after the January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. Now an international group of overseers will make a decision for Facebook that could have a significant impact on the future of free speech and politics. Casey Newton is the editor of Platformer. It's a newsletter that looks at the intersection of tech and democracy, and he joins us now. Casey, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
How is the process with Facebook's oversight board going to work?
Well, the case has now been referred to them, and they have accepted it. And so over the next 90 days, they will be considering the question of whether to bring Trump back. As part of that, Trump will get to submit a statement if he likes, and other interested parties can weigh in. Free speech experts, activists, a lot of people will have a say. There's a public comment period. And then at some point, the board will make a ruling.
Who's on the board?
Well, it's a very diverse international group. Facebook drew heavily from people who have law degrees. There is a former prime minister of Denmark on the board, experts in constitutional law. And of the five-member panel that will decide the case, only one is actually required to be from the United States. So it may be a group of international scholars and experts that are making the primary decision here.
So tell me more about the evolution of this board. I mean, why would Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg want to give up his power to make the decision all on his own?
Well, it turns out it's kind of a horrible power to have, because every single day Facebook makes a decision that outrages hundreds of millions of people. And for years now, all of that outrage has landed on one person, Mark Zuckerberg, who has total control over Facebook's board and everything that happens on it. And so his idea, which had been suggested to him by some legal scholars, was to create an independent body that could shoulder that burden. You can almost think of it as like a monarchy trying to add a judicial system.
Interesting. So what are Trump's chances of getting back onto Facebook? I know you've reported that the decision could actually just end in a stalemate.
It could, although that does seem unlikely. I think the board will probably make sure that it comes to a conclusion here. And the experts I've talked to are very mixed on this. You know, Facebook has said that it is extremely confident that the board will agree with its initial decision. But there are a lot of people in academia who are extremely uncomfortable with the idea of a private corporation being able to take away speech rights on a platform that is used by billions of people, even if that platform is owned by a private company that is allowed to make its own rules. And the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, there will be other politicians who do other awful things, and this case may sort of set a precedent for them. So I think the board is going to be trying to think beyond Trump, even as it considers the particulars of this case.
You make such a good point, and that's why this is actually a very important story, because either way this decision goes, it's going to be a pretty significant moment in social media and actually, frankly, corporate history. So, you know, what do you think? What is the example that it sets for the future of politics and for corporate governance?
Sure. So, just to name one example, in the Philippines, they have an authoritarian leader, Duterte, who has also incited violence against his own people. And activists there have called for years for him to be removed from the platform. Facebook hasn't done that. In the aftermath of the board's decision, maybe Facebook will feel compelled to remove Duterte too, and then who else, right? So there is a chance that this could be the first domino to fall in a series of them.
You know what this sort of implies to me is that these social media companies wield as much, if not more, power than ostensibly the most powerful man in the world, the president of the United States.
It's very true. You know, as a young reporter, I used to think business was the most boring beat. You know, who cares whose stock was up or down? And then at some point, these businesses started to be larger than the states that we live in. And as you point out, arguably more consequential. So the power of the internet seems to grow over us all the time. And I think it's why we do need to see experiments like this that are designed to return some power and accountability back to real people.
So that's Facebook. What's happening over at the other social media platforms? Because, you know, Twitter, of course, has banned the president as well.
Right. Although somewhat hilariously, they refer to it as a permanent suspension, which still seems like kind of contingent to me, you know, like maybe they'll change their mind. But let's assume that he stays banned there. You know, he is currently under suspension at YouTube. One of his communities, which he was not officially linked to, but which, you know, existed to celebrate him, has been removed from Reddit. So the president doesn't have a lot of safe houses on the internet right now. And we'll have to see if he's, you know, able to reclaim any of them in the coming months and years.
Wow, what a story. Casey Newton, editor of Platformer, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Callum Borchers. This is Here and Now.